Great. Thank you for the introduction. So my only disclosure today is that I don't have a really fun and cool Boston accent to engage you with. But seriously, I have no disclosures. A couple of the objectives that quickly that I'll speak about is to speak to the inequities in those affected by housing discrimination and exposed to lead paint, and discuss the importance of academic partnerships and local government, and also if there's time to share a little bit of data between our city partnerships, our city partnering agencies, and our progress towards addressing the issue of lead paint in the city of Boston. So this is the laundry list of all of the things my little office does. So we're a small office of, we have 11 FTEs, and we have between 8 and 9 interns. So the intern piece tells you how much work we really have. So I'm only gonna focus on the investigations and enforcement piece in the Boston Lead Initiative. So really talking about fair housing as a public health issue. So one of the things I want to highlight is my office has the federal distinction of being a FAP. So we're a Fair Housing Assistance Program. And to become a FAP, an organization has to show that it enforces laws that on their face provide substantially the same rights, procedures, remedies, and judicial review provisions that are substantially equivalent to the Federal Fair Housing Act. So we investigate housing discrimination, we enforce the fair housing laws, and then we do that through our administrative purview. So we actually have hearings in our office, and we have hearing commissioners. We have mayor-appointed commissioners that act as hearing officers. So getting into the fair housing and public health piece. So thinking about what we need for fair housing and public health. So safe and stable, affordable housing is one of those key components. But I want to also share here that when we think about Healthy People 2020, that includes creating social and physical environments that promote good health for all as one of the four overarching goals for the decade, which really speaks to creating healthy housing. So I think one of the things that we see is that families are denied housing because they have a child under the age of 6. That makes their housing status, their housing not stable, and that's also illegal. When families are told they must pay more in rent due to familial status, their housing is not affordable, and that's also illegal. So those are some of the things that we're actually trying to get out to the community, that these things are also illegal, and there are some remedies for you. There's my office, and there's some other city offices that we partner with. So fair housing and public health, just a little bit here in terms of the law. So speaking about the protected classes that experience housing discrimination associated with lead paint. So on the federal level, familial status is protected. That includes pregnant women and families with children under 18. And then first, Massachusetts state law, receipt of public assistance. So I'll talk a little bit about the data that we see in our office, but we see strong correlations between the familial status piece and or receipt of public assistance, including Section 8 in terms of discrimination associated with the presence of lead paint. And the reason we see it with Section 8, being a Section 8 housing voucher holder, is there is a pre-inspection process that you can go through as a landlord for Section 8 to receive Section 8 voucher holders. And folks will, in order to avoid going through that process because they know they have lead paint, they will avoid renting to folks who have Section 8, particularly if they have children. And that's something that we see in our office. So in terms of the data that our office sees, this is 2013-2014, about 100 or so cases, but this is really reflective of what we typically have seen in our office throughout as far as our office has been established. So our office has been in existence since about 82. So in terms of the familial status highly associated with lead paint, that's about 26% of our cases, and then 20-ish percent of our cases that's also denial of Section 8 that is also associated with lead paint. So in those cases, there was a strong correlation with the familial status piece, so those were all families with children. So with regard to fair housing, how does lead paint end up leading to discrimination? Landlords do not want to renovate housing to accommodate a child, children, or pregnant women, so they deny families or lie about availability. They use language to discourage families from applying, and this can be particularly difficult for families that are receiving public assistance. So lead exposure in child's health. So I think, you know, if folks didn't know, you'll know by the end of today that lead paint is still an issue. So not just for Boston, but for other cities that are as old as Boston. In terms of our housing stock, we have the third oldest housing stock in the nation. A couple things I just want to highlight here. In terms of our state law has a blood lead level of 25 is where we consider children to be poisoned. The CDC recommendation was 5, and I believe that just dropped recently. So then there's a newer recommendation, I believe, of 2. And we know that there is no level of exposure that is safe. And if folks want to find out a little bit more about what we're doing on a state level in terms of our policy work, go to Bill Berman's session. So our partner, our academic partner from Suffolk University Law School Housing Discrimination Testing Program is here. He's doing the next session in S103A on social determinants of community health, and he's going to talk about the state law pieces that we're working on in terms of lead abatement bill and education for realtors and brokers on fair housing law. So just in terms of the social cost piece, so I'll go over these things fairly quickly. You know, I mentioned the piece about loss of one IQ point is actually linked to 1% of loss in lifetime earnings. There's a local researcher out of Amherst, Massachusetts, Jessica Walpole Reyes, who's an economist who has looked at children who have been exposed to lead paint and their MCAS scores versus those children that were not exposed to lead paint and the MCAS scores. And you know, there is a link in terms of reduced testing scores and exposure to lead paint. So behavioral costs, health costs, of course, and the decades of research that talk about causality between lead exposure and health and other health costs. So the piece about our old housing stock, so just in case folks are wondering, the Scranton, Pennsylvania area is number 1 in terms of oldest housing stock, and number 2 is the Buffalo, New York, Niagara Falls area. So this is just some more information about Boston. Boston is very neighborhood-based, and we have old housing, and this is where we see some of that old housing. I'll also show some more detailed maps. So one of the things that we did in our partnership was that we looked at where do we have census tracts where we see 50 or more children with an elevated blood lead level of 5 and above. And where do we have the oldest housing stock in Boston? So we found that there were 3 neighborhoods where that was pretty significant. So that's East Boston, Dorchester, and Hyde Park. So one of the things that we wanted to do was also focus in our resources between my office and other city departments to really focus in on these neighborhoods. So just in the context of Boston and thinking about who is exposed here. So the blue and the pink dots are, blue are Black or African American folks, and then pink are Hispanic or Latinos. So in terms of where folks live, thinking about those census tracts that I just talked about, so Dorchester, Hyde Park, and East Boston, those census tracts are in areas that are majority Black and Latino. So in terms of children that are being exposed here. Some other demographics that we saw in those census tracts are lower family income, several lead-related housing discrimination cases in that area when we also mapped our own data from our office. English is not necessarily the native language or spoken in the home, and also a higher number of people born outside of the U.S. live in these census tracts. So again, this is just to show you an example of the issue that we're seeing at the census tract level. So in East Boston, of 50 or more children with a blood lead level of 5 and above, it was actually 66 children. And East Boston, for this particular census tract, 87% of the homes were built pre-1950. Similar to the other census tracts as well, so I won't go over these in great detail. And I'm going to talk a little bit about those academic and local partnerships now. So this is Bill's program, the Suffolk Law School Housing Discrimination Testing Program. He'll speak a little bit more about what they do in his session. But one of the things that his program has been really helpful with is they actually look at facially discriminatory ads. So if you go on Craigslist and you see an ad that says, no kids, not deleted, you know, that's illegal. So one of the things that he'll do is actually send testers and see how they're treated differently. So if it's familial status discrimination in this case, send a family with a child, with an obvious child under six, and then send a single person, see how they're treated. So those are some of the things that that his program looks at. And we also work together to apply for funding and support each other when we're applying for additional funding as well. So in terms of our Boston Lead Paint Initiative, that includes multiple departments within the city of Boston. So this is an interdepartmental effort created in response to the numerous cases that we see, but then the public health problem in general. So it's the public health department, the Department of Neighborhood Development, they have a Lead Safe Boston program. They receive HUD funds for deleading and abatement. Inspectional Services Department, and then our office. So a couple of our goals here. We want to reduce the number of children exposed to lead paint and the number of families victimized by housing discrimination. And we want to increase the number of lead safe units, lead safe renovations in older homes, and the public education that this is still a problem. So one of the things that we hear anecdotally from folks is that, oh, isn't lead not a problem anymore? Why are we still working on this problem? Well, from earlier, I think the earlier slide where I talked about where Massachusetts has the level of 25 as the blood lead level where children are considered poisoned, we're out of date. We're out of date, and all of the other states in the nation that have lead laws and have housing stock as old as us are at a blood lead level of 10 or 5. So we did a good job a long time ago, but now we're not caught up with everyone else or the latest research. So in terms of our partnerships, one of the things that we also have is the Lead Paint Working Group, which actually acts as a roundtable to collect recommendations in terms of how can we reduce that barrier to housing, the discrimination that families experience. So we have multiple sectors represented here across academic sectors, occupational health, health and affordable housing. And for health and affordable housing, some of these are advocates that are not affiliated with a community-based organization or a nonprofit. They're volunteers that live and work in the communities affected, so particularly those high-risk census tracts that I mentioned earlier. So again, in terms of some of the pieces that we're doing, we're also looking at a lead paint study. So we are looking particularly at those neighborhoods where those high-risk census tracts exist. We're trying to collect information on perceptions of lead paint as a health issue. So what do people believe about lead paint as a health issue and exposure to themselves or their children, and do some education around those pieces as well, and education around the resources that exist in the city of Boston. We happen to be in the good place that we're a very well-resourced city in terms of resources to address the issue. What we are finding is those resources aren't always utilized, and it's hard for people to navigate the government system to get to all of those resources. So that's something that we're trying to do, and really that if folks get to any one of our partners, we're going to refer you to the other partner and explain what you're eligible for. So in terms of our partnership progress, one of the things that's made our partnership really successful is the fact that our Mayor Walsh, our Boston mayor, has been very supportive of this initiative. So none of us have funds for this initiative, so we're all doing this with our current city funds on top of everything that we do, so trying to align our advertising in terms of the resources that we provide and do some cross outreach work. So the last week of October was Lead Awareness Week, so we did some social media campaigns on that. We also did a lit drop in one of the census tracts of concern, and we have seen an increase in terms of folks coming into our office for discrimination cases and folks going to our other partners to try to access those deleting resources. So this is the picture from our lit drop in Dorchester. And then in terms of the data that we're currently collecting, so for the City of Boston departments, one of the things that we want to, we're collecting data since January of 2015, so that really reflects that quarter one place, and quarter three reflects up to this month. So how many units are we deletting? How many folks are we actually educating about fair housing and the lead law? The lead inspections from Inspectional Services Department, and training contractors in lead safe renovations, so that's something the Public Health Commission does, as well as homeowners being trained in safe and lead safe renovations. So the local, what the local program, what the local city health department offers is that landlord, folks that own their own home can do some renovations on their own without having to be a contractor or go through the EPA renovate, repair, and paint training. So we're seeing some successes. We're increasing our numbers. Our education numbers have been really good. And the lead inspection numbers have increased, which is good as well. So just a couple of lessons learned here. Gaining support from the mayor has really been crucial to moving this forward and ensuring that people feel accountable in terms of making those numbers, because we're also doing some quarterly reporting to the mayor. And then it leads to more transparency, accountability. It's led to some media coverage. So the Boston Globe recently did an article on the issue of lead paint, which was great because we hadn't, I can't tell you when the last article was in a major newspaper around lead paint in Boston. So that was exciting. Making some more explicit connections between the lead paint issue and fair housing, and all of this is really a public health issue, and maintaining committee relationships. We do have an intern who's a public health student, so she's an MPH candidate out of Boston University, who's been supporting this work since the summer, and having someone in that role to work across the department has been crucial. So City of Boston, we're the third largest employer in the city, 17,000 employees. All of these departments that I work with are not in City Hall. So my office is the only one in City Hall. Everyone else is across the city. So having one point person to kind of help us work across and coordinate has also been a crucial piece. And that's it for me in terms of what I'd like to share today.
Okay, so all four of these presentations related to policies, programs, and systems for improving equity. So questions from you. Anyone who have questions, so they will please present and indicate to whom you are addressing your question. Yep.
I have a question regarding lead-based paint. Wasn't it about
do we have houses that still have things from the original, and so that is a major factor, is that before that law came about, the lead was already in the house.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the other piece that we find is that folks are not aware of what the resources are. So one of our partners, Department of Neighborhood Development, has a Lead Safe Boston program. They just got a couple of million more dollars from HUD specifically for lead abatement funds. So it's $8,500 per unit, which is typically the cost. So if folks are not selling their unit or their building within 5 years, that basically becomes a no interest loan that is completely forgiven. So we are in a good place where we have those resources, and every year we find that the program has money left over and we don't have people taking advantage of the program.
And these people are contractors or owners of homes?
Owners of homes, yeah. And one of the things that so there are some income eligibility requirements, but one of the things that HUD has done to ensure that more people are eligible is that they either go by the income of the owner or the income of the occupant. So if it's a rental property, whoever's income is lower is how they gauge the eligibility.
Another question? I have a question about Margaret. You talked about, you did a survey of different organizations in terms of what structures there that might deal with the issue of equity. You talked about partnerships. What did you mean in terms of partnerships? With whom did you develop a partnership to get the survey done, or what did you mean when you talked about partnerships?
So, sure. So, partnerships was actually a
section.
Okay,
can you remove the microphone?
So, partnerships was actually a section of the survey. So, it was it kind of represented a combination of measures that we used to address how health agencies are partnering for health equity. So, it wasn't so much that we were partnering to put out the survey, but rather that we were assessing whether health departments are partnering for health equity, and if so, how, like in what ways are they just sharing information? Are they maybe taking on some more explicit form of partnership where they work directly on an initiative? And we asked about a number of types of other agencies at the local and other levels, and also gave them an opportunity to write in other answers as well. So I'm happy to share more of the details on what sorts of partners we came up with, but the partnerships data was actually presented earlier today by one of my colleagues. So we've got lots more information there as well.
Okay, so you have done your survey and you found that certain organizations are structurally associated with equity issues. Did you have a chance to, was there any indication that with the enthusiasm with these organizations participated in equity issues?
I think that's a great question, and it definitely was not something that was within the scope of the survey. So this was really just quantitative analysis of what sorts of structures are currently in place in health departments. So between different iterations of the survey, we did do some key informant interviews and some case studies with specific states on what their health equity initiatives are. And so that was certainly an opportunity for us to find out some more enthusiastic states and what they're doing, and maybe some new innovations that are happening that aren't widely spread yet. But it wasn't within the scope of the survey really to ask about
I sense that I was just wondering that when you're asking questions that people are going to be telling something quietly, and you know what's really going on, they may not want to, and there were no questions that dealt with that, but just a sense as to what, and I was wondering what type of organization that might give that kind of response. But,
right, that's a great question. That may be a great next step to find out. Yeah,
we'll do a whispering campaign to find out. Okay, any other questions from the group? Okay, let me see. I have a question from Jenny. In terms of, you talked about preventable hospitalization. What are you, what's your definition of preventive hospitalization?
in terms of pre-funding?
Well, what I used was the Agency of Healthcare Research and Quality, their indicators. So they identify, it's actually by ICD-9 codes, and they identify the conditions that they found to be through extensive literature review have been associated with potentially preventable hospitalizations. And again, the like acute conditions, these tend to be dehydration, urinary tract infection, and then with the chronic conditions, it's, you know, chronic conditions that which could have been maybe dealt with better in a primary care office, that they could have been treated in a primary care office, and then because it ends up being exacerbation of diabetes, hypertension, and asthma, and COPD. But again, it's using the identifiers I used were through the Agency of Healthcare Research and Quality, so it's something that they've put a lot of time and effort into in terms of determining what is qualified for clinical hospitalizations. And this has been something that's been evolving over the last...
Use the microphone.
Oh, sorry.
Can you hear about that? Okay.
Sorry about that. So as I was saying, it was I used the Agency of Research, Agency of Healthcare Research and Quality, their identifiers, and it's, they've done extensive literature review in terms of identifying what would be preventable hospitalization, and in terms of, again, acute conditions, as I mentioned, dehydration and urinary tract infection, and bacterial pneumonia, and then with chronic conditions, again, it's exacerbation of chronic conditions, things that could have maybe been treated early on, but because they weren't treated,
I'm not that familiar with pre-clinic, maybe some of you are, but when I think about a pre-clinic, I tend to think about, not primary care, but a thing that does not require hospitalization.
I think
people are coming in and, STD kinds of stuff, coughs, kinds of stuff. That's just my mind when I think about pre-clinic. And I'm not thinking about surgery or somebody who is going or who is thinking about going into a hospital. Of course, that might be the case. That's just my narrow thinking of pre-clinics. So that's why I was concerned. So that's why I was interested in when you use the word preventive hospitalization, because I didn't know people went there because they were near having to go into the hospital.
Well, the concept would be that you would have access the free clinic for primary care, you know, over the year, and because you didn't have a free clinic available to you, that you then didn't have as an uninsured individual those resources to help somebody help you maintain your hypertension or give you indicators of when that needed to be under control. So it's not, you're absolutely right, you don't go to a free clinic for surgery. It is primary care. But it would be something that would be happening earlier on, in maybe a year beforehand or 2 years beforehand, would be when the service would have occurred.
Okay, and so you did your study in North Carolina, and you showed us that you got a graph of North Carolina to where the clinics were located, were spread all over. I was interested in, and you did mention that they're from rural to urban, but where most frequently are they found? Urban or rural, across the board?
It's pretty much across the board. It kind of follows the breakdown in the state. You might get inverted, but I think it's 60% rural and 40% urban. That's kind of consistent with that.
And then in those clinics that are in the rural areas, I live in Tennessee. I live in an urban area, but we talked about the rural area. Who man those clinics?
For all the clinics, they tend to be, they vary significantly from clinic to clinic, and even the number of hours that they operate can vary significantly. Some of the smaller clinics may only be open 3 hours a week, versus the larger clinic can be open up to 40 hours a week, like more of a full-time clinic. And then again, they're going to vary by who actually works there. You tend to get a lot of volunteers for administrative side, as well as the healthcare providers. typically the executive director is somebody that's hired in a paid position, and beyond that, it varies from clinic to clinic. And I like to say, if you see one clinic, you see one clinic. so it doesn't necessarily represent the other clinic.
Do you have a question?
Yeah, I have a
question. Okay, and is the Nina? Yes, Gina. In terms of, if you were talking about doing studies of people participate in research, based on your research, is there what one would consider, like we have here, lessons learned, what might you say that you have learned from conducting the study to find out the degree to which underrepresented populations participate in these studies?
Most of the scoping review, but I think one of the lessons that I took away mostly was what I sort of said at the end, which was, you know, thinking about being more proactive in terms of how we do actually enroll and recruit and retain people of color and women in trials. We're at the reporting stage when I'm talking about this, right? I talked about manuscripts from over 20 years or something, but if we think about thinking about the issue a little bit earlier is a small step in terms of how do we actually make sure we have the representation in a clinical trial, how do we make sure that that actually happens. So if you're in New York City and you're, or anywhere per se, and you are going to recruit a specific hospital, and maybe you aren't going to be able to get the representation across racial and ethnic groups, would it not behoove sort of the funding agencies or NIH or regulations or mandates to think about how we can help you do that? So why don't you recruit maybe a community clinic or a community hospital that's next door that might have the population to actually boost your and have a more representative and generalizable result in terms of these groups. So that's part of the National Initiative for Minority Recruitment and Clinical Trials. That's sort of what we're trying to understand, sort of what is the underlying issues, and then how do we create tools to help researchers actually do what I'm sort of saying, or how do we actually do, you know, provide guidance or training or best practices for retaining the
group? I have heard people talk about engaging people in a study, and one recommendation is to pay them. So, because we find that we want to get people from underrepresented groups. I know when I volunteered for with agencies, there's cost in transportation, there's cost in time. So, in order to get some people who we want to participate in these activities, they have to get there. And so they may need, I was a member of the American Cancer Society in my county.
Right.
And it was difficult getting people to come, so we had to pay for transportation. So I was wondering, based on the literature, was there any indication as to remunerations or some kind of incentives like that, or other types of incentives to get people to participate? It's time. It's all our time when we're participating in these committees.
Right. Well, to that point, some of the formative work for this study talked to patients, talked to PIs, and we talked to coordinators in terms of what are the barriers actually to participating in clinical trials. And one of them is clearly time and money and transportation and childcare. Childcare, right. So that's the other side of it. And this was sort of looking at sort of the barriers in terms of recruiting, sort of inclusion, right? But if you think about how do we actually get people involved, those are easily some of the barriers that we identified, and thinking about putting those costs when you, again, going back to the budget, right? If you don't have the budget for it, you're not going to be able to provide transportation, or actually you and your staff go to where the folks might be. That's also, we want to make sure you're doing that. So it's, again, sort of thinking about your budget, thinking about what might be included in terms of actually getting the people that you want in your trial. And that comes sort of upfront, but you sort of have to have that advanced thinking in terms of inclusion, but also some of these
Okay, I've been asking questions. No questions from the audience? Okay, well, thank you very much for your participation and your attendance. Thank you.